Welcome back to Tour Guide Tell All. In this week's episode, we take a deep dive look at the history of our nation's favorite pastime and our nation's capital. That's right, the great sport of baseball. We'll take a look at the predecessors to our beloved world champion Washington Nationals and uncover a few fun facts about baseball in D.C. Every once in a while, we like to take the time to highlight a special organization here in Washington, D.C., working to make the city an even better place to live. And this week, we'd like to highlight the work of SMYAL. That's S-M-Y-A-L, or Supporting and Mentoring Youth Advocates and Leaders. For over 25 years, through youth leadership, SMYAL creates opportunities for LGBTQ youth to build self-confidence, develop critical life skills, and engage their peers and community through services and advocacy. Committed to social change, SMYAL builds, sustains, and advocates for programs, policies, and services that LGBTQ youth need as they grow into adulthood. One of our favorite Washington Nationals players, and all-around good human, world champion closer Sean Doolittle, has dedicated countless hours promoting their work, and his exceedingly talented wife, Erin Doolittle, has been a board member for several years. You can find out more about the organization, or learn how to volunteer or donate, by visiting their website, smyal.org. And now, let's talk baseball.
Let's talk baseball. It does feel weird without Dan.
It does. I miss Dan.
I would like to start by saying this is just the women's history side of me, that Take Me Out to the Ball Game is one a great song. And I hate that we never sing the opening part because it is a song about a woman saying, I don't want to go to Coney Island. I don't want to go on your fancy dinner date. I want you to take me out to the ball game. And yes. I love that. It's so feminist.
And it was written by a man who'd never been to a baseball game. Which is so weird. And he wrote it in like a subway ride while he was in New York and had never been to a baseball game and just got inspired. And here we go.
So this is going to be very like niche for Washington, D.C. baseball fans. I still to this day sing Aha after Take On Me. And I know now they've embraced it again. Like just everyone gets into it and they play it on the, over the speakers. But for a long time, they didn't. And it was just very hardcore fans. So I think we could probably just start singing the beginning of Take Me Out of the Ball Game and it would continue because that's what it's like at a Nats game. So we are going to talk all about Washington. Well, I guess not all about Washington baseball because we're going to focus it on a particular team that not everybody seems to have heard of. But let's talk about baseball personally. So I think I'm Candon talking right now. Then there's Becca, Rebecca.
Hi.
And we're all doing this podcast, Tour Guide Tell All, but we're also like another little group within the DC Tour Guide community that loves the Washington Nationals. Have we all been to a game together? That birthday? Rebecca, you were not at Becca's birthday, right?
I think I've had, my birthday is in May, so it's usually like primo baseball season. So I think probably the 10 years I've lived here, probably 8 of those 10, I've done a birthday baseball game with like a group of people. That's like my tradition. If there's a home stretch around my birthday, I love getting people together and going to the park. And I've even had my name up on the, you know, the birthday thing. And actually our wedding weekend, we had our, you know, happy wedding, Becca and Matt, you know, on this, that was like the one thing I really wanted to have us on the Jumbotron for celebrating a wedding.
Yeah. All my birth announcements have been Washington Nationals themed. Adding nice. A player to the bench or whatever.
And so did you guys, what is your baseball history? Becca, you grew up Houston area. Were you a Houston fan from like way back when?
Yeah, I don't know. I won't speak for everybody else on this podcast, but I grew up like just as a kid, straight up loving baseball. That was the thing we did with my dad was going to games. And I grew up in Houston, so I was a huge Astros fan. I still very much have enjoyed the Astros, although a little bit
recently, I guess. Do I need to cut this part out?
No,
you can keep it. I'm just kidding.
I loved going to the Astrodome. To me, there is still no weirder / better place to watch baseball than the Astrodome. But when I moved here, you know, I love watching baseball in person, even more so than on TV. So then you're going to Nats Park to watch games, and I just sort of fell in love with the Nats. And it was such a great year last year to be a Washington Nationals fan. We, I think, are diehards. Like, we were there for the team in the bad years and the low times. So it was so fun last year to be at the wild card game with you, Cannon, and to be at the game one watch party with you, Rebecca, to really get to celebrate the incredible 2019 season. And as far as I'm concerned, the Nationals will be World Series champions forever, because baseball may come back different this summer.
Oh, that whole thing about if they do the designated hitter for both leagues, then Sean is the last one. I speak about Sean Doolittle like we're friends. More importantly, I'd rather be friends with his wife. But
yes,
Aaron, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the podcast.
We love It's Lit. That was my favorite video series ever done by a baseball player and his way cooler wife.
Yes. So I actually am, my baseball history is, I grew up in the New England area and I grew up as a passionate Red Sox fan.
Is there any other kind?
No, there is no other kind. My father's a Red Sox fan. My uncle has had season tickets to Fenway Park since the 70s. And when the first year he was a season ticket holder, the guy who held season tickets the row in front of him had the season tickets since 1918, which at that time was the last time the Red Sox had won. So I have always been ride or die for the Red Sox. But I moved away and then they started winning, which is terrible. And I moved here and there was no, when I've lived here, I remember back in the day when there was no baseball team in Washington. So it didn't make sense to change my allegiance because there wasn't anybody here. And I'm not going to root for the Orioles. But I remember very strongly, one of my favorite DC memories is when the baseball team came from Montreal. And the first day, I remember very clearly the first day in 2005, I remember when the Nationals were awful. So it's been really fun. And this is the first time I've ever lived in a city when a team is winning. The team that I'm rooting for is winning, living in the city. So it's been really fun.
Do you feel like you now have a curse that's been lifted off of you? Now you can rest assured it's not you that was the problem.
No, I don't think that it's me necessarily. I was pretty happy when the Red Sox won in 2004. That was a pretty big life moment. My siblings and my dad and my friends, we all called and each other and cried, and it was beautiful. But I didn't feel that there needed to be a curse lifted off of me. I felt very bad for the Washington sports scene for so long, that they had such not great sort of lackluster teams. But I'm glad Washington has sort of thrown that curse off with the Nats.
So I do not come from a sports family. I did not watch sports growing up, except for my mom's dad. My grandpa would always watch baseball with the volume all the way up, beyond all the way. You could hear it throughout the house. And it's obviously the same announcer. There's only one announcer who has ever done baseball games ever. They all have the same voice. Mm-hmm. So it's always, every time I listen to a baseball game, which I prefer to do, I do love going to the games. I much prefer to watch them at home. I like my, my pitch track. I like my FP and Bob, but, it always, I also can hear that they lived across from the Tyson Chicken Factory, so I can hear the chicken trucks going by and, the ceiling fan on high because we're from the South. But I'm from Durham, so I grew up with Durham Bulls. My first job ever was at the ballpark. I sold cotton candy, and by sold cotton candy, I would pick up my rack of cotton candy and then just go sit in the stands and watch the game, and if you wanted cotton candy, you could come to me. I was not about to walk around and carry that very heavy thing and yell cotton candy to everyone. I was just there to get into the baseball games for free. And I remember the old stadium, the one from Bull Durham. So when they played there as kids, you could go underneath the bleachers. So when we were little, we used to go get the ice cream in the fake plastic cup, which I love still exists today, and hang out under the bleachers. And we were 8 or 9. We were just eating ice cream. We weren't doing anything weird under the bleachers. And then I moved abroad. So I lived in Europe and South Korea, where actually we did go to baseball games in South Korea. South Korean baseball fans are intense. If you think we were intense, it's like a national cheer. They all know it and they all do it at the same time. And it's very weird if you don't know the cheer. So I know lots of South Korean cheers now. But I grew up with the Braves as my major league team. As a kid, my goal in life was to be the first female Atlanta Braves pitcher. And I went to the very first Orioles Braves baseball game down at Turner Field. And I caught a foul ball off of Chipper Jones. And after the game, and this was 20 years ago, I'm still mad about it. After the game, I go down and I'm trying to get Chipper Jones to sign my ball for me. And he just like will not give me the time of day. He just completely ignores me. I'm still mad about it to this day. You can ask anybody how I feel about Chipper Jones and the Braves. When he played his last game here at Nat Stadium and everyone's cheering, I refused to cheer because he would not give a little 12-year-old Braves fan an autograph. And I hold a grudge. But then when we were abroad, you know, everyone knew about the Braves. I kind of felt like a bandwagon fan. I kind of got off baseball for a while when I was living in the UK. And then we moved back here and my now husband is a big Rangers fan. He saw one of Nolan Ryan's no-hitters. So I became a Rangers fan. So I watched all of the Rangers game. They went to the World Series and broke my heart. And we moved to Washington, D.C. And I was like, well, I don't really feel like I have a hometown team in the major leagues. So I kind of adopted the Nats again, kind of when they weren't good either. And now they're good. And I love it. And we go multiple games. I've taken both of my kids. I'm very proud that my now 3-year-old, but even at the age of like 1.5 and 2, will sit down and watch a game, the whole thing, because we're raising him right. But yeah, I kind of went off on a tangent there. I miss baseball.
So much.
You talking to just reminds me how much I love Bull Durham. I mean, I love all baseball movies, truly, but Bull Durham
is special. Classic. It's so special.
Have you guys been to the ballpark?
No.
I have not. I really want to go. And I hope that we'll someday go to South Korea because I really want to see a baseball game in South Korea.
Oh, it's intense.
I've actually never been to Durham.
What?
I don't know. I haven't.
Okay. I've just never been. Yeah, you got to go to Durham, girl.
Side note, I'm biased, but I love Durham. And in 2018, it was voted number 3 place to go in the world underneath Rome, which I still don't understand. But Dan has those Durham Bulls hat and he needs a new one. So we were talking about how one day we need to all go to Durham. Not anytime soon. Don't go to North Carolina right now.
I love minor league ball. I love minor league ball parks.
Oh, yeah. It's very fun.
And I do. I miss baseball in general. I miss all of it.
It's like the backdrop to your summer every year. Mm-hmm. Like there's always a game on every day. It may not be your team, but there's always something it's always there in the background.
And I love DC baseball fans. Those who follow me on Twitter know that half my Twitter friend group now are Nats fans, a lot of whom I've met in the park or met virtually and then became friends with at the park. They're sort of like, Cannon mentioned, the subset of DC tour guides who are also really passionate baseball fans. Sometimes we get lucky enough and we get paid to go to a game when an 8th grade school group gets tickets, and it's like the best job perk when you get to go to a game for free. And I miss that side of our job too, getting to integrate baseball in with guiding.
One of my best days of my job ever was there's this group that we used to do. They came from Massachusetts every year. And one year they happened to time their trip, and they would go up to Camden Yards to go to a game. But one year they happened to time their trip to the Red Sox being at Camden Yards. And I mentioned that I was a big Red Sox fan, and they loved me so much that they went to their school group people and were like, do you have 2 extra tickets? And they found 2 extra tickets for me. And my husband and I got to drive up to Baltimore. And I remember being like, I have to get rid of my tour tonight because the Red Sox are in town.
I do believe that even when I'm hiring and training new guides and I talk about, you know, there are good reasons to say no to a tour request. And Nats tickets is one of them. I'm like, oh, I can't do a tour tonight. I'm going to the Nats game. And I say, that's fair. I'll cancel the tour. But not this year.
No.
But all of our love for the Washington Nationals aside, what we want to talk about is the Washington Grays.
The Homestead Grays.
Washington Homestead Grays. The Homestead Grays. A team of many names. So the Washington Grays were part of the Negro Baseball League, which has many iterations and has a very interesting history. And I believe Becca is going to share with us kind of a background.
Yeah, you know, obviously we're all big Nats fans, but baseball has been in Washington, D.C. a long time. Kind of famously, the Washington Senators was the team that was here for many, many years. I know them most famously from the musical Damn Yankees, because that's my life. But even going back a little further, you have the Washington Grays, who were a part of the Negro League. But a little bit of history about African-American baseball players and sort of this entire baseball community that boomed in and of itself. Just as kind of of taking it back to the Civil War era. Civil War is kind of a great time for baseball, despite it being a terrible time for the country. You've got all these people from all over the country mixing and mingling, and baseball is spreading. It really becomes super popular during the Civil War. And as soon as the Civil War ends, there's a huge interest in leagues. So there's leagues cropping up all across the United States. There's touring leagues, travel leagues, regional leagues, different companies are underwriting leagues. So there's this real big boom. The National Association of Amateur Baseball Players is formed in 1867, which is 2 years after the Civil War ends. They're the first major professional league. And then just a few years after that is the National League, which we still have today. There's pretty much an unspoken rule when these leagues are formed that they're going to keep out Black players, but sometimes they didn't. When there was a good player, if there was a player that could pass, and in a lot of the smaller traveling teams, especially in the North and Northeast, you could find some integrated teams. Not often, but some. By the 1880s, though, there were some really big players that were crossing color lines in some pretty popular minor league teams, especially in what was known as the International League. So you've got this sort of like unspoken rule, but yet baseball teams want the best players, and some of the best players were not white. And then you get a man named Moses Fleetwood Walker. Moses Fleetwood Walker should be way more famous than he is because he's basically Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson gets all the credit for being the man who breaks the color barrier in baseball, but technically, Moses Fleetwood Walker was first. He was the first African-American to play in what was considered a major league. It was the American Association back then. Today we would know it as the American League. He played for the Toledo Blue Stockings, which I will just say right now, when I say the names of any of these old-timey teams, I'm going to do like an old-timey dance because I love the old names. The Toledo Blue Stockings. He was actually the starting catcher on opening day, May 1st, 1884. I mean, it's like nice that he was a starting catcher, but it was actually one of the worst starts of his career, and it was well documented, which was kind of uncomfortable for him. So he's actually the first African-American player to play in a major league. 1885, we have our first professional all-Black team. That's the Cuban Giants, and they're going to play for about the next 20-some-odd years. So you've got this time in the 1880s, and this sort of parallels to something Rebecca and I talked about in the Frederick Douglass episode, where you sort of have this post-Civil War era where there's maybe not full-on integration, but there's more places where things are kind of coming together. We have advances in terms of race relation. But then as we get to the end of the 19th century, things are backsliding, and that's reflected in professional sports. By 1889, both the American and National Leagues, or the American Association, ban colored players from playing. So you've got about 30 years after this where it's pretty much impossible for a player of color to play on any sort of professional league. This is going to change in 1920 with a man named Rube Foster. Rube Foster is the father of Black baseball. He's going to form the Negro National League. Rube was himself was a player, a very good player, a pitcher for nearly a decade. He played for the Fort Worth Yellow Jackets and for like five different teams that were called the Giants. Every team, if you do baseball history, every team in the first part of the 1900s was like the Chicago Giants, the Cuban Giants, the Racing Giants. Like, they were not very creative with the names at all. Rube Foster is a pitcher. He's at the top of his game. He takes teams to championships, but he also knows his body is taking a beating as a player, and he decides to get into managing. He becomes manager of the Chicago American Giants. See, there's that name again. And he basically innovates a new style of play. It's very aggressive. It's much more focused on getting on base, right? It's a little kind of almost early version of the money ball of like trying to get the base count up, get those numbers up. And that's going to really be the foundation of how they're going to train players to play in the Negro League. He becomes the first president of the National Negro League. He models the entire league on the structure of Major League Baseball, and he has a real knack for financing. So he actually gets underwriters and investors. There's a lot of interest in the Black community in investing in baseball because it's a chance for Black businessmen to advertise and promote. And he does so well that his players actually get paid better than players in the American Association and National League. They get better salaries. They have better hotels, quality lodging. They travel in private Pullman cars. So there's sort of this golden age for the Negro National League in the early 1920s. Unfortunately for Rube Foster, things are going to go bad. He really works himself to death working on the league. He's also exposed to a gas leak, which causes a nervous breakdown. He has a total mental break in 1926, and he dies in 1930. So you kind of see the rise and fall of that first National Negro League with Rube Foster, because it was really his baby. I do like to mention, too, for those listening with the name, I think today when we hear the name of like Negro League or National Negro League, it can sort of rub us the wrong way, or it can sound really foreign to our ears. But at the time, the NAACP actually was advocating for the term Negro in lieu of colored. And so they actually put out pamphlets and information to newspapers and writers to encourage them to use Negro with the N capitalized for respect for the race. So we're going to use that term as they did at the time. But I found it really interesting sort of looking at the NAACP and what they were saying. It's also interesting because as much as they were promoting the Negro League at the time, there was still not a lot of day-to-day sports coverage. So it's really hard today to go back to newspapers and find a lot of coverage. In fact, for the Washington Grays in DC, there was no sports writer assigned to the Grays beat. So there was maybe occasional coverage, but there was nobody covering every game. And it was really hard to find stats on a lot of these games. Now, initially, when the National Negro League is formed, it has eight teams. I'm going to say their names because they're all really great. There's the Chicago American Giants, then the Chicago Giants, which I'm sure wasn't confusing, the Cuban Stars, the Dayton Marcos, the Detroit Stars, the Kansas City Monarchs, which I think are one of the most famous Negro teams, the Indianapolis ABCs, and the St. Louis Giants. This will lead to the formation of the Eastern Colored League, and there'll be two circuits that will hold championships for several years. So they essentially have their own version of a playoff structure and the World Series. Unfortunately, though, the league is going to struggle, and then it's going to be the Great Depression. So there is going to be a bit of a slump, and the league will reform officially in 1933. It reforms as the National League, with the American League coming in 1937. Things are going really well for a couple of years. There's a big East-West All-Star game. These games are huge. They bring in 50,000 spectators. There's a lot of money pouring into the leagues at the end of the 1930s, but then World War II happens. And then in 1945, we have Jackie Robinson. Robinson will break that color barrier in Major League Baseball. And by 1948, the MLB officially integrates. So the interest in a Negro-only league is going to really dissipate. So the history of this professional league time is pretty short. We're really only talking about a window of about 20 years, but out of that time are going to come some of the best players in baseball, period, and certainly some really cool teams, including, of course, the Washington Grays. So I'll turn that over, I think, to Candon to talk a little bit about the Grays specifically.
So had you guys heard of the Washington Grays before? When did you guys first hear about the Washington Grays? How new are they to you?
I heard of them because I watched Ken Burns' documentary about baseball, and I'm not gonna lie, that's where I heard about them from.
Becca?
Pretty much the same, although I definitely, when I moved here, started hearing people talking more and getting more integrated to the sports scene here, started to hear people talking about the Grays. I think we're lucky because we sort of came up in the era with Ken Burns baseball and this time where baseball historians were finally writing about these leagues and these players. So I think we were lucky in that regard. But yeah, if it wasn't for Ken Burns,
I was going to say, how much historical knowledge do we have because of Ken Burns?
So
did I tell you about the time I met him and fangirled out, and I'm still embarrassed about it? So if he happens to be listening, I saw him at an event at the Smithsonian, and I went up and I had him sign my book for me, and I go, oh, I'm like cringing at this. I go, hi, I really like your movies. And then I just like, he just was so lovely and said thanks and signed. And I walked away. I was like, oh my God, first of all, they're films. Second of all, what a stupid thing to say. I am sure that I had heard about them from watching Ken Burns baseball because I know I've seen that, but it didn't stick with me. And then living here in Washington, D.C., and when I started researching RU street tours, is when I got more into hearing more about the Washington Grays. Now, as I said earlier, they went by many different names. So same team, Homestead Grays, Washington Grays, Washington Homestead Grays, different names, same team. They were a phenomenal team. They won 9 consecutive pennants. They won 3 Negro League World Series. 11 of their players are in the Hall of Fame, most notably the powerhouse hitter Josh Gibson, who I believe Rebecca will talk about later. So the Grays weren't supposed to be a Washington, D.C. hometown team. They were originally the Homestead Grays from Homestead, Pennsylvania. So this was the beginning of the 20th century, and Industrial League baseball was pretty popular, very similar to like company baseball teams that we have to now. But these guys were actually very good. Somewhere from about 1900 to 1910, they were the Blue Ribbons, another fun early baseball name. So the Blue Ribbons, they were not a formal team, and they were not playing in a formal league. And then for about 2 years, they reorganized under new management and were the Murdoch Grays. And then in 1912, they became the Homestead Grays. And that's kind of when they became professional, and that name pretty much stuck with them throughout. So you have to remember, Homestead, Pennsylvania is a suburb of Pittsburgh. So this is industrial Pittsburgh. These guys were mill and steel workers. It's just that whole area was gray. But it was also kind of the Toledo Blue Stockings and the Red Sox and the White Sox. So a lot of sports names at the time kind of came from the clothing that the teams were wearing. So here in Pittsburgh, everything, including the uniform, was gray, hence the name, the Grays. So it was around 1912 that Cumberland Posey began to play with them. And he was part of the team really in some form or fashion for pretty much its entire existence. They played in the Negro American League for one season, the one season that it lasted in 1929. And they played in the East-West League in 1932. But for most of the existence from 1912 onwards, it was an independent team, until it joined the National Negro League in 1935. So the 1930s to the 1940s were kind of the pinnacle for the Homestead Grays. And I read a whole great article about how many baseball historians consider the 1931 Homestead Grays one of the best teams in baseball. So if you're a big baseball fan, baseball historian, you might say, wait, no, 1927 Yankees. First of all, the Yankees are never the best team. And I, Rebecca is shaking her head in agreement.
Oh, sign 100%.
Those damn Yankees.
Those damn Yankees. Worst. I'm very anti-Yankees for multiple reasons. They play occasionally good baseball.
I'm very anti-Yankees for, make no apologies.
I mean, the Ken Griffey Jr. article about the movie that just came out about how he would never play for the Yankees. I mean, I love Ken Griffey Jr. anyway. But regardless, 1927 Yankees are often held up kind of the standard best team in baseball. But the 1931 Homestead Grays, they were an incredible team. That year, they had a 143 win versus 29 loss record. So this lovely baseball history nerd wrote this whole article about a test that he did where he took all of the stats he could find about the 1931 Grays versus various other baseball teams throughout the Negro League, Major League Baseball, past and present, took all their stats, plugged it into a computer that had the teams play each other based on their players' stats, and the 1931 Grays were by far the best. This independent team, the Homestead Grays from suburban Pittsburgh, how is this relevant to Washington, D.C.? In 1940, the team started to play in Washington, D.C. as more of a home team. So they played in Griffith Field, and it was the same field that the then Washington Senators played at. So when the Washington Senators were on the road, the Homestead Grays would come and play the field in Washington, D.C. Griffith Field was on U Street. It's pretty much where Howard University Hospital is today. It was then, still mostly is today, a predominantly Black neighborhood. D.C. residents of all races were big Senators fans, even when the Senators, the Washington Senators, were not very good always. You may have heard first in war, first in peace, last in the American League. That was all about the Washington Senators, the D.C. baseball team.
I mean, I have to jump in and say the literal plot of Damn Yankees is a guy willing to sell his soul to the devil so the Washington Senators could just for once be a winning team. They literally wrote a whole musical based on how bad the Senators
could. They do have a winning season. They win the World Series in the 40s, 43.
I mean, they were pretty bad. But, you know, the D.C. fans loved them. I mean, you can still love a baseball team they're no good.
Hey, talk to Brooklyn. You
know? There are many franchises out there. If I say the Mariners, does that mean? I'm just kidding. fans loved the Senators. They were very supportive of their local. So Griffith Stadium, it was segregated, but when the Senators went off on the road and the Homestead Grays come and play, I mean, they were good. They were entertaining to watch and the locals loved them. And so as the year started going by and the Homestead Grays played more at Griffith Stadium, they loved it. The fans loved them. The Grays kept coming back. In fact, the Homestead Grays games drew more fans than the Senators games did. So DC became the home away from home in 1940 for the Homestead Grays. They became the Washington Grays when they played in town or the Washington Homestead Grays. So during World War II, a lot of the major league teams kind of either stopped playing, couldn't field an entire team, shorter game, shorter seasons. It's the same reason that we get a league of their own. The Negro League teams continue to play, and that's when the Homestead Grays would start to play a lot more here in Washington, D.C. So in 1943, they played more than two-thirds of their home games were at Griffith Stadiums in Washington, D.C., rather than their actual home in Pittsburgh. So they played at Forbes Field, which is where the Pittsburgh Pirates played as well. They really hadn't played in Homestead, Pennsylvania since about the 1920s. So there's this powerhouse team. They won the league titles in, and I had to write this down, 1931, 1937, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43. And then they won the World Series, 44, 1945, and then 1948. And the team fielded some pretty impressive Hall of Famers that Rebecca is going to talk to everybody about.
Yeah, so the Negro League is really fascinating to me. There were so many different characters that are involved in not just the Homestead Grays, but the Negro League in general. And the conditions were for the Negro League, you know, they didn't have home stadiums the way that like the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees did. They kind of played on off days and traveled on the days when the major league teams were in town. And they statistics weren't kept quite as well because it was considered to be a little bit lesser of an enterprise than Major League Baseball was. And so it is not the statistics that we have for a lot of these players are incomplete at best. But any discussion of the Homestead Grays and their players really needs to start and end with Josh Gibson. Josh Gibson was known, just to give you like off the bat, just how great he was known as the Black Babe Ruth. They were contemporaries. They played basically around the same time. Gibson was a little bit younger than Babe Ruth, but there are a lot of fans who saw them both play, both Babe Ruth and Josh Gibson, and actually ended up calling Babe Ruth the white Josh Gibson. So that's to give you a sense of how really great he was. And it really, for me, you know, Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige, who I'll talk about briefly in a minute, they're just the tip of the iceberg in terms of all of this talent that does not get utilized by the Major League Baseball. And it always, you know, when people talk about how Babe Ruth was the best baseball player of all time, it's like, well, yeah, but he didn't play against all of the competition available. So there's that. Josh Gibson has a really almost a meteoric career. He starts playing at 18 years old and basically stays connected to baseball for the rest of his life. He's going to play most of his career, although certainly not all of it, with the Homestead Grays. He, in 1933, to give you a sense of his prowess, he hits .467 with 55 home runs in 137 games, which is ridiculous. His lifetime batting average is .350, which is like almost insane. He, in 1934, the next year, he hits 69 home runs, and the rest of the league only hits 52, the whole rest of the league. So he's like outpacing the output of the entire rest of the league. He's a huge power hitter. He is actually a really decent fielder as well. He's widely considered to be the Negro League's, if not their best player, then pretty close to their best player. Josh Gibson has some demons. He has an alcohol problem, which gets markedly worse in his sort of early 30s. He has a brain tumor that he refuses to let them operate on. He's worried that an operation will wind him up being a vegetable. And so he continues to play and actually has even more productive years after the brain tumor is diagnosed. And it's still in his head in the 1940s, 1943, and 1944, when the Negro Leagues are going to win the world championship for the Negro Leagues. He dies in 1947. He dies of a stroke at 35 years old, just a few months before Jackie Robinson is going to break the color barrier. And one of the great tragedies of sort of Josh Gibson's life is that he felt that he had been passed over, that he couldn't sort of showcase his talent on the major league stage, and is going to just not quite live long enough to see Jackie Robinson do that. It also is worth mentioning, he never played for the Homestead Grays, but you got to give a shout out to Satchel Paige. Satchel Paige was the best pitcher of the Negro Leagues, but probably the best pitcher ever to play the game, certainly in contention for the top three. Satchel Paige is going to be the first African-American player to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, followed very closely by Josh Gibson. So they're number one and number two. Satchel Paige makes a very, he's the second player to break the color barrier, but by that time he's in his early 40s and so is well past his prime. And so his major league career is not sort of as glittering as it would have been had he been in when he was younger. There's also another really great pitcher that pitched for the Homestead Grays named Cool Papa Bell, which is the best name in baseball. I dare you to name me one that has a better name than Cool Papa Bell. Cool Papa Bell is a little bit younger than Josh Gibson. He's a little more contemporary with Satchel Paige, but he's also going to be a center fielder. He is apparently one of the fastest men ever to play baseball, and stories of his speed are still sort of widely circulated. He's ranked 66th on the list of all-time great baseball players. Other person I want to mention, Candon already referred to him as Cumberland Posey. Cumberland Posey is double threat. He actually is both in the National Baseball Hall of Fame and the National Basketball Hall of Fame. So he was a pretty accomplished basketball player as well. He is basically going to stick with the Grays for most of his professional life, first as a player and then as a manager. He realizes that his body is not kind of holding up. And so he moves into a manager. He also was a talent seeker in his capacity as management. He was very aggressive about it. The rules were a little bit different for the Negro Leagues than they were for Major League Baseball. And so Posey was really one to poach players from opposing teams. He was really well known for being a little bit of a shark as far as getting other players. He would raid clubs' rosters and entice other players to abandon their teams and play for him. And that's going to come back around on him when other Negro League managers get wise, because obviously they're gonna. And in the early 30s, the opposite happens to him. He has a bunch of really high profile players poached by other teams. So he gets back on top though. And by the end of the 30s, he's winning pennants again. So Posey is going to be pretty close to Gray's baseball for the rest of his career. Yeah, I know, Cannon, you wanted to say something else about Cumberland Posey.
Yeah, well, there's just, when I was like reading and research into this, so his family was very interesting. His dad was one of, if not the first Black licensed engineer in the United States. And his mom was the first Black graduate of Ohio State University to go back and teach there. And he was the captain of the golf team. And I think he played football too.
So a triple threat, really.
And he was kind of the all sports.
And it seems like he kind of grows up relatively well off.
I think he was well off.
Yeah, yeah. His family's connected to Henry Clay Frick, which is the Pittsburgh area. That's sort of coal and all that. So he's comes pretty wealthy. And I love that he just turns into a baseball like guy and just kind of hangs out in dugouts.
But when you were talking about his management style, so before him, before he was manager of the Grays, there's a different gentleman, Vanny. He was a church going man and didn't believe that baseball should be played on Sundays. So he wouldn't schedule games on Sundays. So a lot of the other players would kind of farm themselves out to other teams to play on Sundays. And then you have to remember at the very beginning of the Washington Grays, and Composey started out as a player too, because he also was a mill worker. But these players, they had day jobs. So this was kind of a fun recreation thing to do. They wouldn't always want to travel for a weekday game because that meant they'd have to leave work. And it was a cooperative. The Washington Grays started out with, like a lot of the other leagues at the time, the players all, you know, they invested in the team and then they split the profits from the games. So that's kind of an interesting way to think about how they got started. This group of workers who worked during the day, played baseball nights on weekends. And then their first manager was like, okay, but you can't play on a Sunday. And then Cumberland Posey comes by and he's like awesome at all sports and has this great mind for management and, you know, allows them to play on Sundays. And then they just go professional and they don't need to work at the mill anymore.
It's really interesting to me that they were paid, the Negro League players were paid on a par with Major League players. Major League players were paid, I mean, we're used to them getting exorbitant salaries today, but for a long time, they were paid nothing. And so it's really interesting.
Especially if you didn't win a pennant or you didn't win a certain number of games, you might make literally pennies.
Yeah.
So very similar to minor league players today.
Yeah, very much. Very exploited.
The cause we'll take up at another time.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is a name that is infamous in baseball circles, but the guy who keeps a lot of these players out of playing Major League Baseball is a man named Kennesaw Mountain Landis. And Kennesaw Mountain Landis is...
It's a great name, though.
It is a great name. His father served the Battle of Kennesaw Mountain in the Civil War. And so obviously when you lose a limb in a battle, you're going to name your child after the battle. Like, doesn't everyone do that? And Kennesaw Mountain Landis grows up. He actually is a judge and he's got a kind of a neat little tie-in to Al Capone. But in 1920, they persuade him to leave federal judgeship, which I wouldn't leave a guaranteed income stream, but whatever. And he goes and becomes commissioner of baseball for the rest of his life. And Kennesaw Mountain Landis was adamantly opposed to integrating baseball. And so until his death in 1944, this unspoken gentleman's agreement where they didn't hire African-Americans was ironclad. It's not at all a coincidence that he dies in 1944 and Branch Rickey integrates Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers 3 years later.
Well, and Robinson signs his contract in 45, although he won't play in a major league game. So, I mean, it's literally like Landis dies and Rickey's like, let's get some contracts. Let's get these guys trained up.
Right. And Branch Rickey's the hero. He really is. Branch Rickey decides we're going to do this. This is what's right and starts to integrate baseball. But Kennesaw Mountain Landis may, in a roundabout way, be the reason that we've heard of Al Capone, because he was a federal judge in Chicago before he becomes baseball commissioner. So he was very pro-prohibition. And had he remained on the federal bench, Chicago might have been a much less accommodating place for the criminal underworld element during prohibition.
So Griffith Stadium was named after the owner of the Washington Senators baseball team, but I cannot remember his first name. So we're going to call him Mr. Griffith. He was obviously not willing to integrate baseball, but I think part of it was more on a financial basis rather than a personal basis. He floated the idea of signing Josh Gibson, actually talked about it with him, but he and Cumberland Posey had a kind of a thought about it because it made them more money to have the two leagues separate, the Major League and the Negro League. So for the owner of this baseball team, he could rent out the stadium to the Washington Grays at the time when the Washington Senators were on the road. Because if the Washington Senators were on the road, then the stadium would just be empty. So he's making money while his Major League team is off on the road. And then on Cumberland Posey's side, if they integrated the leagues, you know, not everyone in the Negro League would have been good enough to make it in the Major League. So Cumberland Posey would lose a lot of his best players. So there's a really interesting article about Mr. Griffith and that kind of that rationale. Why he thought Josh Gibson was a great player and probably would have been very successful and better than a lot of the players on his team. Granted, his team wasn't always very good. So yes, Josh Gibson was better than a lot of the players on the Washington Senators team. But if he signed Josh Gibson and kind of started that trend, it would lose him money. And that is how owners of baseball teams think.
Clark Griffith.
Clark, there we go. Thank you.
Yeah.
I do think it's important to mention to listeners that if you go to Nats Park today, we do have a statue of Gibson there, which I don't love the three sculptures at Nationals Park, but I love that we only have three players currently honored with sculptures, and one of them is Josh Gibson. But I wanted to mention Cool Papa Bell for a moment, who is just so great. He's got incredible anecdotes. He lived a really interesting and rich life. But I love the way he talked about his time in the Negro League, because he actually lived long enough to talk to some reporters and talk to people in the 1960s and 1970s about his time in the league. And he really kind of encapsulated how different they played than the major leagues. He said that they played tricky baseball. I love that. He said, we played tricky baseball. We did things they didn't expect. We'd bunt and run in the very first inning. Then they would come in for the bunt and we'd hit away. We always crossed them up. And he really took a lot of pride in talking about how they would work out trick plays. They'd work out the psychological game, right? And it was a style of play that wouldn't make its way over to the major leagues until much later into the 20th century, and they were doing it way ahead of the team of the time.
I read that Cool Papa Bell, when he was would single to first base, pitchers would not like to pitch to the next guy because Cool Papa Bell was notorious for stealing second and third and then scoring on the next pitch. So he would like somehow manage to do it. He stole first. And I've been around
tricky baseball.
Tricky baseball. Like, I've been around baseball since I was a kid, and I can't imagine anyone stealing first. Like, it's just...
You gotta be fast.
You gotta be really fast.
I also think one thing we should mention about the Negro Leagues that makes it different from the rest of baseball, Major League Baseball, is that they had women. Not a lot, but they had women who played in the Negro League. My favorite is Toni Stone. Toni Stone is an incredible, incredible player. Her real name was Marcinia Lyle Alberga, so you can see why she used a different name. Toni Stone is a much catchier name, and it kind of sounds like a male baseball player, Toni Stone. But in 1953, she got a single off of Satchel Paige, and she was interviewed about it later in her life, and she said, he threw that fastball, and I just stood up there and hit it across second base. And then she laughed, according to the reporter, heartily. But Toni Stone is one of my favorites. But if you spend some time in Washington, D.C., you might hear about another woman who played for the Negro League, and that's Mamie Peanut Johnson. Mamie Johnson didn't play for the Homestead Grays. She played for several other teams, but she spent most of her life, I should say, she wasn't born in D.C., but spent most of her life here in Washington, D.C. She was actually part of the dedication of like Nats Park and did events when the park opened and was very involved. She just passed away a couple of years ago, but if you go to Men's Chili Bowl now on U Street, right outside in the alley, they have a newish mural and she's included there, but she was called Peanut because she's only 5'3". And one of the pitchers who was pitching to her sort of said, I can't possibly throw to her. She's no bigger than a peanut. And that's how she got her nickname. But there were several women who actually got to play in the Negro Leagues, not their own separate league. And I think that's something about the Negro League that doesn't get enough attention, is that at the end of the day, if a woman could run and pitch and hit, she could play.
I love that. Love that.
So we didn't really go over the end, the legacy. So with the signing of Jackie Robinson.
It's basically the death knell. Yeah.
He signed in 45, plays his first major league game in 47, and that's really the beginning of the ends of Negro League.
Yeah, and they can all see it coming, too. The National Negro League folds the next year, in 1948, and baseball hasn't even been fully integrated, but other half of the Negro League hangs on throughout the 50s. They kind of try to make it, but it's very clear that as more and more clubs are integrating, fewer and fewer people are going to attend the Negro League games, and so they eventually do.
Yeah, I think the Grays' last game was last year is 1952.
Trivia question. Anybody know who the last Major League Baseball team to integrate is?
I do know this. It's the Yankees, right? No.
Nope.
Oh, no. Why do I know this? I know it.
Candid, do you know?
I feel like that's a trick question, though, because, like...
Is it the Senators? Is that going to...
No. Okay,
it's not, no.
I was going to know. I was like, it has to be, like, it depends on, you know, did they exist or not? Who was it?
It's my beloved Boston Red Sox.
Oh, the Boston Red Sox. Oh, of course, 12 Boston.
12 years. It takes some time. Because Bob Yawkey, who they're taking his name down off of Yawkey Way because he was a terrible racist. He refused, and this is part of the reason that the Red Sox stunk throughout the 50s, is because other teams are integrating and he refused to do it. That takes them until 1959, so 12 more years for the Red Sox to integrate.
I think when we think about the legacy, though, of the Homestead Grays, there was a lot of attention last year with the Nats having this incredible turnaround season and kind of making this beautiful Cinderella run to the playoffs in the World Series. And everybody kept saying, well, they haven't had a pennant. They haven't had a pennant since the Senators. And people just sort of kept forgetting about that 1948 Homestead Grays World Series win. And I think that one of the good things that came out of the Nats run last year is there was a lot more local press and local conversation about the Grays, about their incredible run as a team here, about the passionate fandom for the Grays here. And I think that that helped bring it kind of maybe into the community in a way that a lot of us who lived here, I think, weren't as aware of the Grays and their legacy. So it was a nice kind of side effect of the Nats doing so well.
Right. I know there were so many, at least the very beginning when they were talking about a World Series game in Washington, D.C. There hasn't been one since 1933. And then there's all the pushback from the generations of D.C. locals and then historians like us. Like, wait, you're not. There has been a World Series in D.C. after 1933, just not of this particular league. And then I think, as you're saying, the media got on board and shared that information with the world as a whole. But let's be honest, the best part of the Nats winning the World Series is that the Nats won the World Series.
The Nats won the World Series. It was really great.
I kept my kids up. We watched it.
It was.
They had no idea what was going on.
The thing I loved about it was that it was never a foregone conclusion that like that went all seven games and they lost all their games at home. And it was just, there was so much drama about it.
It was such a good season.
The number of times we were down going into the seventh inning, the number of times we were on, you know, the last pitcher in the dugout. I mean, it was just drama at every single step along the way. And that's what I loved. It was the perfect baseball season. And as somebody from Houston, having the Astros win the World Series in 2017 after Harvey, then to have my favorite team growing up as a kid and then the team that I've grown to love here playing together in 2019 was so incredible and special. And it was, I thought, just like the perfect couple weeks of baseball. It was so, so fun.
It was the Becca series.
It was the Becca series. I'll be honest. Yes. It was amazing.
And at the beginning of the playoffs, every time I would have an evening tour while the Nats were playing, they would win. And so as things got more and more tense, as we were getting further and further along, I wanted to stay home and watch the games because, you know, I'm a fan and give away my tours. But I kept thinking to myself, no, you can't mess with the tradition. You can't mess with the superstition. So I would have to give a tour and I would openly tell my tour groups, listen, the Nationals are in the playoffs. I will be checking my phone. If you don't like it, tough.
I just remember the last home game I went to in 2018 was their last or second to last home game. You know, 2018 was such a bummer of a season, really. It was pouring rain. Maybe 20% of the park was there. You know, 20%.
My Red Sox won.
It was great for you, but for Nats fans, not so great. You know, 20% of the park was there. About inning three or four, they told everyone to go to the lower level because they were like, we're clearing up the upper decks. So we were literally behind the dugout, pouring rain, maybe, you know, seven or eight beers, I don't know, in us. And I just remember knowing that it was the end of the season, but getting to cheer for all of our favorite players. They would come and wave to the fans that were out there in the rain. They came and talked to the kids and signed stuff for the kids afterwards, even though it had been that bad. I just felt like, looking back now, that was like a promise of like, there's always another year. And we got that in 2019. So I look at that last 2018 time I was at the park and I'm like, man, at the time it sucked. But then looking back, it was just like why I love this team and this baseball community in Washington. And I hate when people say we're not a baseball town. I hate that so much. Those are people who don't live here and don't get it.
And it also, as someone who's lived in Washington for on and off for almost two decades now, when I moved here, we were a football city. Everybody had
Washington football team
everywhere. They would fly flags and attach them to their cars. And it was a big deal. And I remember when I was young and single, I went on a date with this guy who was absolutely convinced that the Washington football team was about to go 16-0. And it was ludicrous on its face, but he was very convinced. And that's obviously why we didn't work out as a couple. But it over time has sort of transformed into being much more of a baseball city. And it's just so lovely to see that everybody kind of comes out. You see Nats hats everywhere. And it's really just the most amazing thing to see kind of blossom in the city.
My argument as to why, I mean, I get why people at face value think we're not a baseball. I mean, they've only been here for just over 10 years. So, well, now more than that. I know it's just 2020 does not seem like it is an accurate number for what year it is. But like we don't have, there is no one who's like a passed down generational season ticket holders. So that's fair for them to say that. But then the other thing is, I just, like myself, I know so many people, like, I can't go to the game in person. But I am, whatever I'm doing, I'm checking it on Twitter. I'm texting you guys. I have the game in my headset. I am somehow paying attention to the game, even if I can't be there in person, because we're not a 9-to-5 city. I don't know anybody with a 9-to-5 job, so we can't go to all the weekend and evening games. So that is just my explanation as to why it might seem like we're not a baseball city, but as Becca said, we very much are.
And I mean, I think you can see that too. You know, people may not be down at the park, but if there's a game in a typical summer, if there's a game, even if I'm downtown or in Georgetown or another part of the city, and I pop in somewhere for dinner between tours, people are watching the Nats, they're talking about the Nats. And that was true before we won the World Series. I see us as a baseball town, just maybe a 21st century version of it, or a different kind of version. And I think the passion here is just as strong as any other city. It just maybe manifests in a different way.
Love the community of baseball in Washington. And I love that when the Nats are doing well, like, you hear about it in like 3 or 4 minutes. Like, it just, I know that part of that social media, obviously, but you get, somebody hits a home run and it shows up on somebody's Twitter feed and they tell me about it in the middle of a tour. And, you know, you hear people cheering from bars as you're walking around the city. So I love the community aspect of it.
All right. Favorite Nats player. I feel like we all have the same favorite Nats player, but maybe we should still say it just in case he listens to this episode.
I don't know if we do, because what current Nats player? Oh.
Current Nats player, oh. I would say, or 2019 team.
Oh, well, are we all going to say Doolittle?
I think we'll all say Sean.
Because if you ask me my favorite Nats player,
it's hard not to. Yeah.
I mean, honorable mention for Juan Soto, obviously, but
I like a little Soto shuffle. Really,
Jason Worth has always been my favorite.
Can we have the intro and outro music be Calma?
Yes. Okay, no, producers are going to cut in Calma at this point.
I don't know if I have the legal rights to do that, but I'm pretty sure I can do 10 seconds.
A la play.
Or you can sing it.
I can do the whole thing, but after last season, but I won't.
I will not sing it because I want people to like this.
You know what? I'm going to be honest. I miss baseball so very much, but part of me is kind of glad because our team's not the same. And I feel like I've been able to keep my 2019 Nationals team a little bit longer than I normally would have.
Yeah, it definitely was going to be weird going in, like, you know, before all this happened with Corona, making plans to go to the first game and do all that and thinking like, oh, it wasn't going to be the lineup. It was going to be different. And that's part of the game. It's why you love it. Yeah. But it's always hard and weird. And Cannon and I talked about this a lot last year, but there were so many Nats players that I wished could have been there for 2019, because they're part of why I love this team, even though they've moved on.
It always is hard when they restart and it's a slightly different team and it looks slightly different, but they still haven't unveiled the banner yet. So we're still the defending champs.
As far as I'm concerned, and I'm not 100% confident that this season is going to happen despite whatever deals are being made.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. Anything else to share about, I mean, we could talk a lot more about the Grays, I feel. We should say, in case anybody is just hitting play on this podcast and not reading anything, that is Washington Grays with an A and not an E, in case you would also like to Google anything more about it, only because we figured that out the hard way. I don't know the difference between the two words. I mix them up all of the time.
I could not find any good information as to why it's Grays with an A as opposed to an E. So I did some research on it. Not like extensive, but I couldn't find anything
I looked to
that explained why.
What is the difference between gray with an E and gray with an A?
No, I love the idea that we don't know. I love that we don't know. I love that all these team names are like lost in the mists of time, that they've been around, you know, because that's the great thing about baseball. It's been around forever. Like the Reds.
Bring back old timey team names.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know what we didn't talk about? Abner Doubleday.
Oh my God. Can I take this one?
Yeah. Yeah. But we should really do a whole episode on Doubleday as a person.
We really ought to do a whole episode. Abner Doubleday.
But let's just answer this. Did Abner Doubleday invent baseball?
Abner Doubleday was a wonderful man and a general in the Civil War for whom he was decorated for bravery, and he absolutely should be at Arlington National Cemetery. He was a very brave man, but he did not invent baseball. He codified the rules, possibly, of baseball. And yeah, that's all.
Even that has a little caveat to it.
Even that is not at all certain. And yeah, he did not invent baseball. I'm sorry.
And I hate that story that like he invented it. Cause I'm like, they were already playing it.
Yes.
Hands clap emoji.
They were already playing it. He possibly wrote down the rules. Maybe not. The idea that Cooperstown, the Baseball Hall of Fame is in Cooperstown because of him is also kind of suspect. It's all a bunch of BS.
Okay. So that'll be part two of this episode. If you guys come to Washington, D.C. and you visit Arlington National Cemetery, preferably with us on one of our tours, we do take you past Abner Doubleday. You'll see baseballs on it. And we will mention in passing that people shouldn't be living baseballs on his grave. We'll happily go with you to a Washington Nationals baseball team. We can both tell you some of the history of the team and Nats Park and show you where to get the good food. And we talk a little bit about Griffith Stadium and more about its history and its exact location on our U Street tour, which you can take in person as a guided tour. But we also have that as a self-guided audio tour if you want to wander down Black Broadway and learn a little bit more. Though I'm pretty sure everything we talk about in the audio tour about the Washington Grays, we have mentioned on this episode. So you guys should all be experts on the Washington Homestead Grays baseball team.
Tour Guide Tell All is brought to you by some of the fine guides at DC by Foot, one of the many cities covered by free tours by foot. And as we start to reopen cities, we are giving private tours. Please check us out at freetoursbyfoot.com. Tour Guide Tell All is Rebecca Grawl, Rebecca Fackner, Candon Arseniega, and me, Dan King. Join us next time on Tour Guide Tell All for a mini episode as I discuss one of our favorite hidden gems in Washington, D.C., the Bartoli Fountain.